delighted to have a local celebrity in the studio, and he really is, James Constantino. James, lovely to have you here. Thank you so much for coming in. You're an East End boy, then?
Well, I'm from sort of Bethnal Green, Hackney, when I was, that's where I sort of grew up as a young boy, and then I came down to Surrey.
So how old were you when you arrived in Surrey?
About 10, 9 or 10 years old. It was a bit of a culture shock to me, to be quite honest with you.
I bet it was, actually. Yes. Do you remember the early days, though, of East End? Is it, and family? And
yeah,
it like
I do. Well, I mean, we went back and forth sort of regularly. So we spent a lot of time there. Our family was from there. I mean, they've all moved out now. It's a changed place. But
yeah.
So I spent a lot of time there growing up. And yeah, it's it was refreshing to come out to Surrey. It was a bit distressing at first, to be quite honest with you. It was a bit of a culture shock, but... You know, I'm glad my parents made the move and everything panned out the way it
did. So what did Dad do for a living?
Well, he was a bit of an entrepreneur. He sort of worked in manufacturing. He had a shoe manufacturing business. They did a lot of sort of for the high-end brands, manufacturing the soles of shoes. And then obviously, I think in the 70s, where a lot changed in the country, there was a lot of foreign imports and that sort
right.
of put an end to that. But we sort of were quite lucky. Financially had the money to drag us from the East End and we planted ourselves here, which was great. And he actually opened the, I don't know if anyone remembers it, but the Wimpy Bar
in
Weybridge High Street.
Yeah. Wow.
So that was an old bank. I remember as a little kid being dragged along to look at it, and it had beautiful old carpentry in there, big old brass handles, the door handles and bronze. A little statue, and I remember thinking, God, this is like another world. And obviously, it was all stripped out.
I bet you were popular at school. If you were the lad that could go around and get some free Wimpies,
I was
and
like
burgers.
That burger sauce. I was like Don Corleone, honestly.
So, what was schooling like for you then, round here?
Well, it was a bit of a shock to when I first came along, because I needed, I sat in my first lesson, and there was kids my age reading and writing, and I thought, what are they talking about, to be quite honest?
Oh, right, okay.
So there was a bit of that going on, but the schools were good. They intensified my needs, if you like, sort of one-to-one, and within sort of 6-8 months, I was pretty much up to speed. So I sort of caught up quite quickly. And then it sort of, I just...
So remind us of the schools that you went to locally.
I went to Cleves, Heathside.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's where I...
Have you still got buddies from those days, James?
I've got a few, actually. Yeah, it's quite nice. It's one's in Australia. I stay in touch with him through social media. And a couple of guys I knew. I knew a lot of guys from sort of Rydens over that way, Walton-on-Thames. And grew up locally, yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your early career. What did you start off as?
Well, do you know what? I mean, I don't know if many people know this, but I did... It's quite... widely publicised. I didn't do too well at school in terms of...
A bit turbulent, I hear.
I was a bit turbulent. I got turfed out at the age of 15. I sat there with my mum. I went home and she said, what are you going to do now? And I said, I really don't know, mother. I really don't know. I remember being asked by the careers teacher, what do you want to do? And I just didn't have a clue.
Right.
All I knew is that I didn't really... I couldn't take instruction very well. And as the teachers found out, so that was a problem to me. So I knew that it would have to be something where I was in sort of steering my own ship, if you like.
Yeah.
And within a sort of year of leaving, I got a job on labouring. I was helped to build Brooklands, the Tesco's at Brooklands. I put in some foundations in there. So I was labouring for a year. My mother used to laugh because she used to come home with orange feet because they turned orange from the sand. I did my fair bit in terms of an apprenticeship, but by the time I got to 17, I realised I needed to go and do something, and I started to buy and sell old classic cars. I always had a love for anything with an engine, whether it was a motorbike and an old car. There's always bits lying around. My mother used to go mad, or oil marks on the carpet. There was always engines around. And when I was 17, someone offered me a guy used to work at the Hand and Spear in Weybridge. I don't know if people remember that.
I remember
it's still there.
Still there.
The landlord had an MG, and he said, do you want to sell? It was like 75 quid or something. Bought that and turned that around. I thought, you know what? I really enjoy doing this.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important. We talked earlier about it, didn't we? About how important it is to be doing something you love.
Like, absolutely.
And that sort of grew, really. So the buying and selling of old cars became a thing. It sort of materialised into almost anything of value that I could find. And I sort of did a bit of travelling as well. So I was in India and Thailand. So I started bringing back containers furniture and artifacts and curios from India.
Fascinating in itself. How did you decide on what to buy and to bring back and to understand even how? It's quite a process to get it shipped back.
Well, I just, I mean, it was quite early days for that sort of thing. That hadn't been opened up in India in the way, you know, too much anyway. And I was sort of early doors on that. So, and I looked at some of the furniture and bits and pieces they had then. I thought, you know what, these would go really well in London if you'd got these down to Lotts Road. And they did for a while. And for a few years, I did very well out of that. I was doing the cars as well. And it sort of just led on to other things, really. And I thought, well, if I can take an old battered car and make it look pretty and sell it for a profit, I can surely do the same with a flat or a little house or something. And that's how it went into the same sort
of... So then you went into housing...
The same process, yes. It was refurbishment. So I was buying from... I first bought my first house when I was about 18, 19, so quite young. And then what I've decided to do, I got to the sort of my mid-20s or late 20s, and I thought, I'm going to sell everything I own, the house, the cars that are on the drive, and I'm going to go to the property auctions, and I'm going to try my luck at buying and selling property. And
I mean, you're incredibly brave, James, to take this stance and that risk. Well, most people wouldn't do it.
Well, I didn't really have a choice, to be honest. It was either that or starved. So because I can't take instruction, it's not as though I could put my hand, you know, I wasn't going anywhere else. So it was a natural progress for me. I'd find it harder to put a CV together, go and have an interview, really, than do what I did. For me, it was a natural, really.
It's in you, clearly. Yeah. It's in you. And is that hereditary? So have you got other family members that have been the same as you, that have been this... That entrepreneurship that you've got?
Well, I was living in the East End. I had uncles that would always go out and they'd always earn a few quid. I didn't ask too many questions about how they did it, but that side of it was, you know, they always managed to get a pound note and always had a sort of folded wad of cash in their inside pocket.
And the way life used to be.
The way life used to be in the good old days. So I don't know if it comes from there or not. I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. All I know is my inability to take instructions from a very early age probably led to me becoming an entrepreneur and trying new things. And you don't succeed with everything, you know. You try things sometimes.
So did you have failures to start with? Or?
I think you've got to, really.
Yeah, you learn from it, don't you?
Well, you're taking risks. So if it was if you were winning every time, it'd be easy. Everyone would be doing it. You've got to allow for some disappointments along the way.
Brilliant. And James, we left you just really getting into those first buys in the housing market.
Yes.
Take us from there.
Well, it started in the 80s, really, to be honest with you. And we were, I was looking at something else to do, to get my teeth into. And I always liked to, I looked at certain properties and thought, I could do that. You know, I could tart that up and make that look pretty. So that's how it really started. I sort of sold everything I had a few cars around me, some classic cars, and I had a house that I owned since I was 18.
Right.
Cashed it all in, went to one of the major, I think it was Barnard Marcus or Allsop or something like that, went along and bought a flat in Weybridge, actually, just at the end of this road, overlooking the churchyard on the corner there. And it actually was made half of what the guide was, so that was good. And ripped it out, you know, did the usual thing, carpets, kitchen, bathroom, and doubled our money within sort of 12 months.
Wow.
And that was great. And then as we were, me and my partner at the time, as we were moving from that, we were living there, and we were just about to go into a rental, there was another one in Mayfield Road, which is then a couple of roads up here. So, and it just sort of spiraled from there, really. And I ended up spending a lot of time at the auctions. I built up quite a substantial rental portfolio.
Right.
The buy-to-let mortgages were... sort of fly, they were really sort of hyping those at the time to get the market stimulated.
Yeah, yeah.
And within about sort of 2 or 3 years, I'd built up quite a portfolio of about 15 properties that were rented out. And that was doing really well. And
you're still doing properties now, you're saying?
Yeah, well, what happened was I always really fancied building one from scratch. So in 2004, I built my first house. I had some garden land and built a chalet style bungalow, and then it just went from there. I got NHBC registered, we did some flats and apartments. I built my parents a house in Weybridge near Cleves School. I don't I'll have to build something that I like the look of, or I'm sort of involved.
And I agree with you. And that's what I've never understood about a lot of British building and architecture. Something, you know, we build blocks of horrible stuff.
Yes.
And you look at, you know, you go across to France, you think, wow, yeah, they get it right, we get it wrong. You know, we could build chateau type houses, couldn't we? You could.
Well, the thing is, I think the planners have got a lot to answer for in that respect. You know, they're not always skilled in certain aspects of development, but for me personally, anyway, it's not about the cash. I mean, I think there's a certain amount of pride in when it grows out of the ground like a sunflower to see something that's architecturally rewarding.
Oh, I agree entirely. So how do we go from houses to pawnbroking? And what made you want to go into that niche area?
Well, we can probably blame it on the Lehman Brothers, to be quite honest.
Okay, so it's that time, yeah?
Yeah, 2008, had some development stuff over in Cobham on the Fairmile Estate. Just sold it, did quite well. Within a matter of weeks, the Lehman Brothers situation, banks collapsed. Bank shares, you know, went down to next to zero.
Yeah.
Banks weren't lending for development. It wasn't actually worth buying any land for development because you didn't know where it was going. If you could get funding. And my background buying and selling pretty much anything. I started looking at, I saw an article in the Times actually about America and how they were funding art portfolios. And I thought, well, why doesn't anyone do that in England? There must be some serious collectors here that need cash at the moment. You know, right. And I started looking at that. And then I thought, well, how could you do it economically without starting afresh? What about the pawnbroking industry? Do they lend against these sexy assets like art and cars? And I found that no, they didn't, and there wasn't really any reason for it other than the fact that they didn't understand it. These old established pawnbroking businesses were used to bits of gold, fob watches,
totally
sovereigns, and that was their bread and butter, and they did very well out of it, and they still do. I didn't really understand that market too well. So what I understood was the concept of buying and selling and to ascertain a value of something that's quite unusual.
I mean, I looked up the origin of the word pawnbroking. One license to lend money at interest on pledge or deposit of goods dated back to 1680. Hasn't changed.
No, it hasn't. There really hasn't been. I mean, there was a little bit of interference from the EU, but apart from that, it's pretty much the same. Yeah, the concept's the same.
So those early days, what did you start to broke in then? What were the first things that really came up for you?
Well, I was quite lucky. I had friends that were in the art business, so they could value the art for me. I knew about classic cars because I'd been involved with that for years.
Okay.
I thought I employed a jeweler to understand the basics of the diamonds and the gold items. And then we advertised, and you know, for weeks we sat in a little shop in Weybridge in Queens Road. Not one person came in. It was quite, you know, I was a bit concerned.
I bet you had your doubts then.
Well, I'd pumped a lot of money into it at that point. And one guy came in, I jumped out of my seat, I ran out, and he said, "Is this the hairdressers?" And I said, "No, they're next door, mate." So, but to be quite honest with you, as soon as people, I tried everything. I did leaflet dropping on cars, got chased out of Tesco's car park by the. We did everything to get the word out of that. But as soon as it got established, it became very easy because people needed that service at that time.
I've defined the origin, but for those that don't and may not understand how it works, how does it work?
Well, it's really simple. So you've got something of value, you need to raise finance quickly, you bring it into me, whether it's a car, it could be a Lamborghini, it could be a Rolex watch, you bring it into one of our stores, we lend roughly 60% of a value, you leave the asset with us, we deposit the funds in your account. You've got the contracts are for 7 months. You can pay back at any time during that 7 month period. So if you borrow the money for 1 month, you'll only pay 1 month's worth of interest.
How does that compare to if I go to a bank for interest? What's the comparison?
Well, I think the thing is with going to a bank is you can't arrange these loans for a bank. So we'll do 100 grand or 200 grand or 300 grand for 4 weeks if you want it.
I see.
So when you compare it, the interest rate compared to a bank is more than a bank. But if you talk about borrowing money 200, 300 grand from me for a month or two, I'll be cheaper than a bank because there's no arrangement fees, no setup fees, and no early redemption penalties. When you take all those costs into account, I'm cheaper than anyone else, probably in Europe, to be quite honest. A guy borrowed £100,000 from me. He paid 2.9%. He paid £102,900 back. He said to me, "That's the cheapest 100 grand I've ever got my hands on."
Right. So short term, it's a really good route for people if they need to get hold of money back very quickly. And presumably the process is a lot quicker than going through.
Oh, well, it can be done within half an hour. I mean, the guy brought in the diamond ring and wanted 100 grand. It was done within sort of 4 or 5 hours, to be honest with you. It can't be done. There isn't another form of lending like it. I mean, it's great, like you say, for short-term lending. Look, if you're going to borrow the money up to a year or 9 months, you want to consider your options.
Right. But
if you need to get hold of anything up to 500 grand very quickly, you know, within a matter of days, and you've got an exit strategy, then the banks can't compete with me in terms of the funds, the rates.
And so you hold on to those goods. How often do people come back and redeem their goods? Is it?
Well, it's quite surprising. 85% of our clients come back. So they either renew and go, you know, they might want more time, or they redeem and pay back the capital and get their items back. 85%.
So that's high.
Well, we don't deal with a lot of people's uncollected assets. People think our stores are full up with but they're not really, because we buy and sell as well.
Right.
So most of the stock in our stores are items that we've purchased from people. Only 15% of our loaning clients don't come back to collect.
That's really interesting. I would have thought it was a lot lower. I would have thought it's more like 50% do, well, 50% don't.
Yeah, I think that's a misconception, a common misconception. I believed
that takes you back to the Dickensian days of 1680s and the way it was, I guess.
Yes. I mean, from my point of view, it doesn't make sense to keep someone's goods, because if I've got those goods and I'm selling them, then I've lost a client.
Yes, yeah, true.
No one's got endless pots of goods, you know, Ferraris.
No.
They've only got a certain amount. And if you keep the client and they pay back their capital and their interest, they're a happy client, you're going to see them again. Most of our clients I've known since almost from day one.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So you started this business. You've got it's kicked off quite well now. 2013, September 2013, yeah. Channel 4 come along. How did all that start?
Well, I mean, we'd had quite a bit of publicity on BBC World News. Some of the other channels had featured us. We've done a few interviews. They wanted to, it was very current at that time because of the climate, a little bit like it is now.
Yeah.
And they came down, they phoned us up, and Joe, my PA, she said, these guys want to come down. I said, no, that's a load of nonsense. Why would they want to listen to us two sitting in this office? Anyway, she said, well, they're on the phone again. Do you want them to come down? I said, so I got him to go on the phone. I said, you want to come down and listen to us? What for? He said, well, we want to do a fly on the wall documentary, just a one-off. We thought you'd be interested. Can I just come and sit with you for a minute, please? So I said, all right. And he said, do you mind if I just sit in the corner of your office and take notes? I said, all right, well, whatever you need to do. So he's sitting there.
So it really is fly on the wall stuff. Just
well, this
just
was
the
just the initial taking notes to present it to Channel 4.
Yeah.
Anyway, we forgot he was there, didn't we? So we started arguing, bickering. I was taking the mickey out of the shoe she had on, and she was saying all sorts of things about me, hair sticking up. Anyway, we heard him go out the... We went out the room, so we're listening at the door of what he's saying, and he's on the phone to his Channel 4 executive saying, I think I've hit gold dust here. These two are going to be very entertaining. So we didn't realise quite what we had, and they made a pilot show for 1 hour. That got record viewings. I think it was at primetime TV, 8 o'clock, I think it was on a Thursday night.
Yeah.
Millions of people watched it,
yep.
And they came back to me very quickly, said, we'd like to do a series. And then another series, and then another. They were filming with me.
How many episodes did you do in the end?
51-hour shows.
51-hour shows.
Yeah, they were filming for over 4 years with me.
Right. So you never really saw the back of them. They were there all the time.
Not really. I mean, there were times you went in the morning and thought, oh, no, not you lot again. I've got to put this microphone on and watch what I say. No swearing.
So obviously that got you fame, literally, across the UK and wider. Yes, because it was...
We were getting people, it's been shown all around the world, but we were getting calls and inquiries from all over, Dubai, America, part Germany, Austria, all around Europe, people wanted to come to the UK.
And tell us about some of the more exotic things that were, because presumably that changed the whole nature of the type of things you were dealing in.
Well, I mean, initially, as I said, it was sort of art and cars. We could cope with that. We went into wine. Wine collections was a big one for us. We sort of fueled the whole secondary handbag market in this country with our offering on secondhand, because there was nowhere to take your Hermes or Chanel, your secondhand. So we sort of fueled that market, and it just grew from there. And I think we were determined that no matter what someone brought into us, we were going to get to the bottom of how much it was worth to make an offer. And I think that's what determined us from... and still does from many of the other people that might want to sort of get involved with what we do. I think we've got, because it's an owner-operated business, it's quite rare for a pawnbroking business of its size to be owner operated, and we can move quickly. Some of these bigger companies, you know, they're big ships, they take a long time to turn.
And you were saying you get a lot of repeat business, a lot of the same people coming back to you.
Many of our clients, and it's funny actually now, you know, people we haven't seen since sort of 2014, 15, next now. So, and you know, and it's
because of the climate again now.
Exactly what's going on.
Times are tough.
It's very similar to those times. Economically, people are finding it very difficult. And we're seeing, and we're even seeing some of the old assets, some of the old collections, some of the old cars, for example.
What coming stuff that you've. Well, been with you before has come back again, yeah, second time round.
Yes, classic cars, wow. Pieces of jewellery, pieces of art, yeah.
And is, if you were to look at all that you're trading, it's all luxury good ends, as you talked about. Is there a particular market, though, is it still handbags? And
well, I mean, look, people say, and we market ourselves at the high end of the market, but in reality, we get a lot of normal stuff. We can do a loan for £100. We're not precious in that respect. It's a good varied mix, to be quite honest with you, because we advertise across all genres, all the asset classes. You know, we get sort of 30% of it be jewellery, 20% of it be cars, 30% art. It's a mixture. It's a good mix, and that's a healthy position to be in.
Okay. Is there anything that ever comes to you where you're going, gosh, I don't know how to value that?
Well, there was quite a lot in the early days. The thing is, with the TV show, that fueled those sorts of inquiries. So we had fossilised whale vomit, and and I was like scratching my head, not wanting to be mugged off on national television. I've got to find out what that's worth. But I think if you're fairly pragmatic in your approach and you're tenacious, you'll get to the bottom. I mean, it's not. There's men on the moon. Let's face it.
True. True. And James, we were talking about the TV series with Channel 4. How many series actually ran?
I think they made about 7 series. There's 51-hour shows, so it's quite a lot. You know, it's quite intense.
And that was over 3 or 4 years,
you're saying? It was about 4 or 5 years.
Four or five years.
Embedded with me every day at all of the branches.
Do you think they'll ever come back and do anything similar?
Well, I mean, there's been some copycat type shows. I'd be nice if they did come back. I mean, it's a totally different ball game now. I mean, at that time when they first started filming, we have tiny little kiosk shop and we're just about to open another one in Richmond. But now we've got these beautiful stores, almost like viewing galleries, full of wonderful assets. This would be so much it would be a more entertaining show. I think there'd be a lot more for the viewer to see. We'd probably have to call it something. It might have to be called Posher Born or something like that. But yeah, definitely. I think so.
And of course, the market, as you talk about, has changed totally anyway. Do people just bring you stuff that they just want to sell?
I sell a lot of stuff. So people think we're just pawnbrokers, but we're not. We buy and sell and deal in luxury assets. We find some beautiful one-off pieces. I mean, some of the Kardashians are wearing some of the items that we've owned, you know, when it comes to bags and things like that. We've got, you know, pieces that Hermes have only made a handful of items. So we get these very unusual pieces, and we've got some clientele that are searching for these, and they're on our books. And when we find something that's very unusual, very selective, we've got a, you know, someone we can go to and we can put these items out. And they're sourcing items for the rich and famous that are looking for these pieces. You can't buy them, you know, you can't find them on the market. So it's pre-sale, so they won't go into the auction, they'll be done privately.
Right.
Yeah, and that's how some of these guys collect, you know, that's how these collections.
Because generally, though, you know, the pre-loved market has really taken off. I mean, you've got, you know, the vintage sales, Vinted as an example, online.
It's gathered pace. Huge. I mean, it's there's the ethical aspect of it, obviously, which is very current.
Yep.
I think people realise, actually, these pieces, you know, if you're buying savvy and you're buying second-hand, you're getting... you're actually making a long-term investment. So you can own a bag that you might have paid 10 grand for, or a Rolex watch or similar. And you know that if you keep it in fairly good condition, in 10 years' time, it's likely to be worth 15 or 20 grand.
Yeah.
That's quite a good return.
Yeah. So you're saying you went from, you know, one little kiosk to one store. You've now got...
I've got 8 stores.
Eight stores across the UK.
Yeah.
Current climate, as we've been talking about, do you feel there's room for further expansion now?
Well, look, I mean, I'm always looking to expand. There's foreign markets to look at, which we've not been into at the moment, but I get inquiries all the time, people wanting to franchise. So
have you franchised it too?
No.
No.
No, not at the moment, but that's something that's sort of earmarked for the future. We're not a brand that some of the other brands, you know, where they've got 200 or 300 stores up and down the country, we could never really achieve that because we're quite tight-knit in what we like to. I like to sort of have an element of control over what we're doing.
You have your control.
All I do. But, you know, I mean, I might grow it to another 10 or 20 stores quite comfortably.
And that's the plan for the
future?
That is
the plan, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
The boy's done good.
I like to think, well, I'm proud of what we've achieved, certainly.
And so you should be. And so you should be. Pleasure talking to you today. If people want to find out more about you, where do they go, James?
Prestige, pawnbrokers.co.uk. You can have a look on there if you want any loan inquiries or if you want to buy anything luxury at shopprestige.com.
So if I come to you with a jet, you better sort me out.
I'll sort you out straight away.
Pleasure to talk to you today, James.
Thanks,
really
Matt.
Nice of you to come in and do stay in touch.
Thank you.
Music. Sorry's loving.